We're holding the Sefer Shmuel, the 13th chapter. And we had seen that Natan HaNavi came to David in rebuke of what David had done with Bathsheba in the story of Uriah Hitti, and had given him an allegory about a person whose soul sheep was stolen by a wealthy person, and David said that the wealthy person should pay four times for what he had done. And the prophet told him, you are the person, and that the prophet Natan had told him that he will pay four times, and God is going to be willing to pass his sin, but he will be punished for it. He won't get killed for it, but he will be punished. And the first punishment we saw last week, the child that his wife bore passed away. And then Bathsheba didn't want to continue with him. She said, any children we have from now on might die, or their brothers are going to look down at them. They'll say, you see that God doesn't approve of this union. And David revealed to her that her next child would be king, and her next child, in fact, was Shlomo, who was named by God Yedidya. And now we are continuing with the description of the Navi as to how the punishments actually came to be, how, in fact, David was punished. And we're going to read about the sins of different people. As the story evolves, we're going to see different sons of David and their improper actions. And we have to remember that we always have Bechirah Chofshit, we always have free will. But in heaven, sometimes there's a decree, as there was over here, that something bad should happen. And the question is just, who will do it? Any person that we are going to learn that they erred, that they sinned, and they fulfilled this prophecy in harming David HaMelech, it's not that they didn't have free choice. They had free choice. It could have been done by someone else. There was a decree hanging in the air that bad things had to happen within David's home. But what bad things, and who would do them, that remained open. And certain people took advantage, so to speak, a disadvantage to themselves, but they stepped forward and they took the responsibility. They did these sins and they're held accountable for them. In a global perspective, these things are punishment to David. But the people themselves didn't have to sin, and they chose to sin, and in doing that, they took the responsibility of the sin to themselves.
But that would mean, don't come to this stage, but if nobody would sin, then these decrees were...
God would find a way for it to come to fruition. Leave that to God.
That's why I said, you don't come to this stage.
So, usually, where there's potential for sin, then there are enough sinners. That's not a problem. So the Navi tells us that David had a daughter named Tamar. And before we continue, let's introduce this. David was once at war. And he saw the daughter of Talmai, the king of Geshur, the daughter of Talmai, a beautiful woman named Ma'acha. And the Torah says that when one is at war, away from home, and one sees a beautiful non-Jewish woman, one may take her one time into his home and live with her. And after that, she has a choice whether she wants to go with him or not. If he wants to take her as his wife, she has to go through a whole procession of gear. And if he doesn't want to, if she doesn't want to, after a year she goes free. And he may not sell her as a servant or anything. He may not hold her as a servant. He has to set her free and let her go back home to her family. And David...
He has to do a number of things before that.
He has to do a lot of things.
She
shaves her head, grows her nails, sits and weeps over her lost family. And he keeps walking in and out of the house and sees her in this not so beautiful state for a month, right? And then, only after that, could they go through the process of gear if she wants to. So, from this union, this one-time thing that David had with Ma'acha, they had a daughter named Tamar, who was as beautiful, or I don't know if as beautiful, but she was also beautiful like her mother. And later on, Ma'acha married David, she was his lawfully wedded wife, and they had a son named Absalom, who was also exceptionally good-looking. Now, legally, Tamar was born out of a communion that occurred when her mother was not Jewish. Meaning her mother did Gerut before she was born, but her mother became pregnant with her while she was still not Jewish, when David met her at war. And therefore, legally, Tamar wasn't really a sibling to her other siblings. She later on became Jewish, but she wasn't legally a sibling to Absalom and to Amnon and to all the other children that David would have.
So that means that
Then they should ask their local Orthodox rabbi, but in general, yeah, that's what we see.
Wait, so what's the status of the baby? Pregnant Jewish woman goes to the Orthodox rabbi. What happens to the child? Is that Jewish or not Jewish?
They should ask their rabbi. We're not doing a class in halacha. This is what we have on this chapter in Tanakh. No, that sometimes a yes or no answer is not accurate enough. So it's not fair to... So Avshalom has a gorgeous sister. They share a father and a mother named Tamar, and he has a brother named Amnon, and Amnon is from another mother. He's a son of David's, and Amnon wants Tamar badly, and he can't figure out what he could do. Now Amnon had a friend named Yonadav, who was his cousin. He was David's nephew. And Yonadav was very, very smart. And Yonadav asked him, "Why are you so upset? I see you all the time. Tell me." And Amnon told him, "I want Tamar, the sister of Avshalom. I like her." And Yonadav told him, "Why don't you lie down and make believe you're ill? And when your father comes to see you, you'll tell him you want Tamar to come and bake me bread. And if she makes it in front of me, I'll see, and I'll get better from her hands." And Amnon really became ill, and the king came to see him, and Amnon asked for his sister to come. Now, let's stop here and ask ourselves, what's going on here? Legally, Amnon could marry Tamar. The Gemara says, we have a Gemara in Sanhedrin, says the following. And this is brought in the Rambam, in Halacha. This is brought. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, the end of Perek Ben Sora Rumore. Rav Yehuda quotes in the name of Rav. Maaseh ba'adam echad shenatan einav b'isha achad. A man got caught on to one woman. And ve'ela libotina, and he was so riled up that he wanted her, that he got sick. And they asked the doctors, "What can we do? The man's getting sicker and sicker. And what do we do for him?" The doctor said, "The only thing you could do to cure him is let him live with that girl." So the rabbis were asked, "What do we do? Pikuach nefesh, the man's going to die." So the rabbi sent the letter back, "Tell him to die." The rabbi said, "He can die, we're not letting him have her." So the doctor said, "If she stands before him naked, that'll also cure him." So the rabbi sent the letter back, "Let him drop dead. We're not permitting her to stand before him undressed." The doctor said, "You know what? If they converse, if he talks to her when he's on one side of the fence and she's on the other side of the fence, then that'll help him." So the rabbi said, "Let him drop dead. She's not talking to him from behind the fence." And the Gemara brings two opinions as to whether she was a married woman or an unmarried woman. And we paskin with the opinion that she was a pnuya. She was a girl that wasn't married. And nonetheless, the rabbi said, "Let him drop dead. We're not letting him talk to the girl." Why? So the Gemara says, because our sages valued the purity and the modesty of a Jewish girl. And they said that we have to ensure that people don't play games, people don't play tricks. Bottom line, she is entitled to her modesty, and we don't make breaches in the laws of modesty in Judaism. So the Gemara asks an interesting question. The Gemara says, "Why don't they get married? Well, seems like a logical idea. Why doesn't he marry her?" So the Gemara says, "Because if she'd marry him, if he would marry her, he'd remain as sick as he was. That wouldn't cure him." Like Rav Yitzchak Todas, from the time the temple was destroyed, the taste of relations with one's wife has been diminished, and it was implemented only when one does it in a sinful manner. As the verse states in Mishlei, "Maim gnuvim yimtaku," stolen waters are sweeter, "Velechem starim yinam," and bread that's eaten in hiding is tastier. And bread very often refers to having a woman. That's a clean way of describing it. That's what Yosef is described, that his master gave him everything he wanted but the bread that he ate. Well, The bread that he ate is referring to the master's wife. It's a clean way of describing it. So here the Gemara teaches us that one, the level of modesty, and two, that it wasn't to cure him. He didn't want what was permissible. If he would have made it permissible, then he wouldn't have been cured.
So what would, I don't understand, would it be the cure for this guy is to sin? If he sinned, if he does this bad sin, then some good's going to come out for him?
The doctors of those times, the doctors said that that's his cure. And the Rambam quotes this in Hilchos Yisod HaTorah, in the foundations of Jewish faith. The Rambam says, whoever saw a woman and he's sick and he's going to die, and the doctors say the only way he could get cured is if he lives with her, let him die. If he speaks to her, let him die. We don't tell her go talk to him. We don't tell her to go talk to him. We don't tell him to go talk to her. Shelo yiyub not Yisrael hefker ve'avo bedvarim elu lifotz ba'ariyot. Because our sages foresaw that if we're going to let a person get away with this claim, I can't, and he's going to die. So the sages said, okay, let him die. Amnon is in a similar state. Amnon is saying, I'm getting sick, I can't handle it, I must have my sister Tamar. Why don't they offer him to marry her? So some want to say because of this Gemara, because that wouldn't have satiated Amnon. Yeah.
Was this Gemara already known in the time?
I don't think so. This is a later Gemara. We're going to see that from the following story, a lot of halachos will evolve from the problems that the unfortunate things that will happen now. Our sages taught us the Mishnah in Avot: Kol ahava she'tloya b'davar, any love that's contingent on something external, batel ha'davar, batla ahava. Any love that's contingent on something external, when that thing will come to pass, so then the love will come to pass. What's an example of that? That's the love of Amnon and Tamar. Amnon's love for Tamar, that's a love that's contingent on something. Why? Because he only wanted her beauty. So what did Amnon love? What did Amnon love? He loved himself. And he loved the thought of the pleasure that he would get from being with her. And we're going to develop this thought as we proceed in the story, because this story teaches us tremendous depth as to a human's relationship with people of the opposite gender primarily, but also with everyone we come in contact with. The Mesillas Yesharim says in his introduction that when we want to define ahava, ahava is defined as the will to give, the will to make someone else feel good, the will to give the person who we love what they need. And that's the secret behind true giving. So then ta'ava and ahava would be opposites. Ta'ava is what a person wants for himself. Ahava is what a person wants to give to others. Ta'ava stems from wanting to take. Ahava stems from wanting to give. That's why we say, the Paskin Mishlei says, l'ta'ava yivakesh nifrad. When a person has ta'ava, when a person has lust, when a person wants, that causes divisiveness. That doesn't cause communion. So Amnon can't figure out how he's going to get Tamar.
Rabbi, the shoresh is hab.
That's what the Mkubalim say, that the shoresh of Ahava is hab, to get an Aramaic. So when a person seeks something, he's seeking something for himself. Ordinarily, if it's going to cause a person to be sick, then at some point the person should say, what do I need this for? Sometimes people are dating, and it's going back and forth, and they're not sure, yes, no, yes, no, and they get sick from it. And at some point, very often they say, hey, what's going on here? Our sages taught us, akin'ah v'ata'avah v'akavod motzin t'adam min ha'olam. There are three things that cause a person to not make it in this world. Jealousy, ta'avah, lust, what a person really wants, and the seeking honor. These are things that a person thinks he's advancing when he wants them. And in truth, our sages reveal to us that they don't cause an advancement, but the contrary. They cause him to exit the world.
Jealousy, lust, honor.
Yeah, it's a Mishnah in Avos. And once a person is engulfed with one of these three, so his logic stops working. He's not working out of logic. He's working out of kinat avar, the lust for kavod. And a person will sometimes be willing to forgo many things for jealousy, out of jealousy, wanting to avenge, revenge. People are willing to do a lot out of jealousy, out of tava, and in the quest for kavod. Amnon should have taken a step back and said, this isn't for me. Amnon sees that he's getting ill, and he doesn't let up. Amnon had a friend, Yonadav, his cousin, who was very smart. Our sages say he was smart to do wickedness. What was Amnon thinking when Amnon gave him this advice? So here it is unclear. Some want to say that Amnon really intended for this rape to take place. That was the advice he was telling Amnon, how to set it up. And some say that Amnon just said, ask your father to allow her to come in and prepare the food before you and feed you. And David, with his wisdom, will automatically understand the root of it. Why is he asking for this girl, his sister, to come in and prepare all this food before him? And then David will figure out how to help Amnon overcome his problems. And in heavens, they wanted David to be punished. So they didn't let David see the root of the problem. And then Amnon was put to the test, and he failed miserably. So Amnon made a mistake. The Gemara tells us that if they would have let that person marry her, it wouldn't have resolved the issue. And what Yonadav didn't understand is that there wasn't true love here. There was tava. And if David would have tried to resolve the issue, it wouldn't have been resolved. What Amnon wanted was to please himself. He had no interest, no true interest in tama. So Amnon gives him the advice. And he's lying there in bed, and he's ill. And his father comes to visit him. And when his father comes, he tells him, please send my sister Tamar, and she should make for me special cakes, special loaves, and feed me. And David sends word to Tamar, please go to your brother Amnon and prepare the food for him. Tamar comes to Amnon's home and he's lying in bed. She takes the dough, she starts making the food. We see she came with dough ready made. She wants to be there the minimum amount of time. So her father said, cook it. So she comes with it ready to cook. She's a little suspicious, it seems. And she starts preparing it. She brings it for him to eat. And he refuses. And he says, everyone leave the room. It's known that if one wants to overcome his yetzerara, then one of the ways to do it is to ensure that there are other people present. When there are other people present, then a person's shamed. Amnon had the exact opposite intent. He wanted to satiate his yetzerara. So instead of taking the one help that he had, that there were people around, he kicks everyone out. And then he tells Tamar, please bring the food to my room and you'll give me tea. And Tamar brings it into the room. And when she comes close, he grabs hold of her and he says, come lie with me. So notice that he said, come lie with me. We can understand that that's just a clean term for what he wanted. Or we can understand that he was fooling himself and trying to fool her. All I want is that we should be together in bed. Nothing more. And if we think about it, then this is very often the way the Yetzer Hara works. When people fall with improper relations, so almost always it begins with things. It begins with yichud, that's forbidden. It begins with negiya, that's forbidden. And then it can evolve to other things where a person constantly fools himself, I won't do it, I won't do it, I won't do it, and then he does it. But he can fool himself until the last second that's not where he's headed. And that's why Chazal always took 10 steps backward and said, don't do yichud, don't do negiya. Negiya is Yisra Doraisa, but yichud, or Chazal, as a result of this story, forbade even with a non-married woman. Yichud with a married woman that's before this story. But yichud with a non-married woman, a woman where he might end up marrying her, that was instituted after this story. David instituted with his court as a reaction to this story, an institution that we have till today, that yichud is forbidden with even a pnuya, even with a non-married woman. And she tells him, don't do it, my brother. Don't torture me. This isn't what's done in Israel. Don't do this disgusting act. She's telling him, you're not my brother. You're telling me, come here, my sister. You're not treating me like a brother. Don't do this, my brother. This isn't the way Jews behave. She's alluding to him. This is what Hamor did. This is the way the son of Shechem did. And you know what happened when he did it? The brothers came and avenged. Dinah killed out the whole city and killed him too. My brothers are going to avenge what you're doing to me. You're going to pay the price. Tamar is trying to do what people always try to do in these situations. Get the other person to think long term. If we'd only think long term, we wouldn't sin. The reason why we sin is because we think short term. We recognize the short term gain and the short term pleasure. And she's begging him, think long term. And she tells him, what am I going to do with my disgrace? And you're going to be treated like such a disgraceful person. You're going to lose all of your honor. If you talk to the king, I'm sure the king will let me marry you. Was she making a real halachic claim because legally she was allowed to marry him? Or was she just trying to stall him? Different opinions. Yeah.
I remember when I was younger, you know, I think, you know, like 16, okay, I'm only 16, I'm just getting started. I'm thinking long term, I can do a little sin right, you know, something silly now, and long term it'll wash itself out. No one will ever remember it. And so what's the difference?
But now that you're older, you know it doesn't work that way, right?
Okay, but still, you see what I'm saying? Somebody who's, especially for someone who's a lot younger, can say, okay, in the long run, it'll wash itself out. So we better do the stuff you want to do when you're much younger, because later I won't be able to. So long term later, I won't be able to, but, you know, this kind of mentality.
Okay, I'll tell you a story that happened. I was once present when a kid was traveling with his family, and he forgot to bring his tefillin along. So he suddenly realizes he doesn't have his tefillin. He says, like you just said, I'm young. Fine. And to his shame, the rest of the family that was home noticed that he left his tefillin. So they call his parents, he's with his parents, and they tell him, hey, Joe left his tefillin. So now the parents come to him, they say, do you have your tefillin with you? They didn't ask him, they said, we just got a phone call from home, you forgot your tefillin at home. So the kid says, okay, I put on tefillin before I left, I'll put on tefillin in two or three days when we get back home. So the mother was very smart. The mother said to him, look, I understand that today you don't care if you miss a day of putting on tefillin. You don't care if during this trip for the next 3 days you won't put on tefillin. I understand you, and I'm not arguing with you. But think, in 10, 15, 20 years from now, when everyone around you, all your brothers and everyone you know, will be able to say that they never missed a day of tefillin in their life. Because of these 3 days, you're never going to be able to say that. That's what the mother told him. She said, look, I understand. They had to abort the whole trip because they were in an area where there was no tefillin, where there was no shul. They had to ruin a large part of the trip because wherever they went, they had to arrange that this kid would get tefillin. He was the only male present on the trip. He was there with all his sisters. But they had to change the whole trip so that he would have tefillin. But that's how the mother got the point across. So sometimes you're right. When we think long term, we think what's it going to be in long term. But we have to know how to think long term. We have to think also what's the gain going to be? What am I going to gain long term? I'm not gaining anything usually long term. Usually the gain is short term, and I'm risking losing a lot long term, like the mother said to the son. And Amnon obviously doesn't want to listen, and he did what he wanted to do against her will. And when it was all over, so Amnon hated her a greater hatred than he had loved her initially. And Amnon told her, get up and get out. And she told him, this is worse than you did to me until now. You're kicking me out like this. And Amnon wouldn't listen. He calls his servant. He tells, please get this one out and lock the door behind it. And she was wearing a nice colored garment that the young virgin daughters of the king would wear, and when she was kicked out and locked out of his home, she took ash on her head and tore her garment and started walking and wailing down. And her brother Avshalom came to her and said, did Amnon do what I think he did? Now you be quiet, don't worry about a thing, you come to my house. and Avshalom took him in. And David heard what happened, and David was very upset. And Avshalom wouldn't talk to Amnon a word, because Avshalom hated him, and he hated him for what he did to his sister. 2 years later, they were shearing Avshalom's sheep, and Avshalom invited all of the princes, all his brothers, and Avshalom came to the king, and he said, "My master, please, you come with all the servants to where they're shearing my sheep." And the king said, "We can't all go, it's going to be a tremendous wait for you." And Avshalom begged him, and the king wouldn't come. And Avshalom said, "Okay, if you're not going to come, at least Amnon should come." So the king says, "Why should he go?" And Avshalom insists, and he begs, and finally the king sends Amnon with all the princes. And Avshalom told his lads, "When you see Amnon fully drunk, I'll tell you, and you see my sign, then you kill Amnon. Don't worry, I'm the one that's ordering you to do it. Be strong." And that's what happens. They kill Amnon, and the other brothers see that one brother's dead. They think maybe Avshalom wants to kill everyone, so they all get on their mules and run. And as they're running, the word comes to David that Avshalom killed out all his other sons, and no one's left alive. And David tears his clothing, and everyone else tears their clothing, and then Yonadav, that same one who gave Amnon the advice how to get Tamar, so he tells David, "Don't think that everyone's dead. Amnon's the only one that's dead. Avshalom must have wanted to, I know he wanted to kill Amnon from the day that Amnon raped Tamar, his sister. And don't think that all your sons are dead, because I'm telling you it's only Amnon that's dead." And Avshalom ran away. And really they saw that the lad who was on the lookout, he saw that many people were riding quickly from the mountain. And Yonadav told the king, "Here, you see, just as I told you, that's what's happening." And as he finished talking, the other princes, the other sons of David come, and they all cry. And everyone's crying, and Avshalom ran to his grandfather, Talmai. And David is mourning over his son for many, many days, because David holds himself somewhat accountable. And Avshalom is now going to stay in hiding for 3 years. Now let's review what we saw for a second. Amnon hated Tamar, a greater hatred than he loved her initially. The Malbim explains that because Amnon's lust for Tamar was animalistic, so lust can bring a person to hatred. Because after he gets what he wanted, so he suddenly feels, "Hey, I'm an animal." When a person enters a moment of intimacy which should represent godliness, and he enters it out of his animalistic instincts without the godliness and the love that should be present, so then when a person has finished, he no longer has that urge and that desire. He got what he wanted. So then he automatically feels, "Hey, I'm an animal." And he automatically blames the feelings he has on the girl, even though she didn't do it, he did it. He did it all to himself. And once he got what he wanted, he spent his energies, so suddenly he no longer had that love, because what did he love all along? He loved himself. He didn't love her. And then he recognizes, "Hey, what did I do?" And then it evolves into hatred for the thing that caused him to come down, even though really it's himself. And that's what the pasuk is stressing, that the hatred turned to love, that the love turned to hatred, that specific love, which wasn't true love, it was self-love, so that quickly evolved to hatred of her. The Torah teaches us that one can marry a woman in battle, and then one can have two wives, and if he hates one of them, he may not treat her children unfairly. And one can have a son that will be rebellious. And our sages tell us that the three parshas, these three laws are written, the juxtaposition of these three, one after the other, is to teach us that if one takes a woman at war, and what's he taking her for? He's attracted to her beauty. Then it will evolve to a situation where he ends up hating her. And it will evolve to a situation where I'll have a son that will be rebellious, because the chinuch won't be proper, because there isn't true love between the parents. Why is he going to hate her? What happens? Because she lost her looks? No, because he never really loved her. He loved himself. And if he took her out of self-love, then the relationship can't grow. It can only go in one direction. At some point, he's going to look in the mirror and say, what did I do? I took a woman by force. I took a woman who's not Jewish. I took a woman and what did I do this for? And ultimately, he's going to look back at himself and say, I'm an animal. No one likes to think he's an animal. She's the one that's making me into an animal. I hate her. Ah, does she deserve it? No. But is that where it's going to go? Yeah, the Torah foresees that's where it's going to go. When David is wailing later on, after Avshalom is going to come back into David's legions, and Avshalom is going to make a big rebellion against David, and David is going to have to be exiled, most of the Jewish people are going to side with Avshalom. At one point, he's going to feel like, I have to go serve idols. It's too much of a chilul Hashem that I am known as God's faithful servant, and this is what's happening to me. And his Rebbe Ira Yairi comes to him, and David tells him, what did I do? So Ira tells him, who told you to marry that woman? Who told you to marry Avshalom's mother? Doesn't the Torah tell you? So David says, what do you mean? The Torah tells me I'm allowed to marry her. So Ira said, yeah, the Torah says you're allowed to. The Torah doesn't recommend it. The Torah foretells you that if you're going to do it, this is what's going to evolve. That if you marry a woman, Aisha Sifas Torah, then her son will be rebellious. And that's where Avshalom is headed. Avshalom is ultimately going to lead a rebellion against David. And the roots of that are here, with what's happening between Amnon and Tamar. There's a book, Ben HaMelech VaHaNazir, in which he quotes the following conversation. He says, a man who was a very smooth talker went over to Yosef HaTzadik and he said, you are a prophet of God. I want you to know that I love you better than all friends. I love you more than any redeemer. And Yosef answered him, he said, I only suffered in my life from love of mankind. My father loved me, so my brothers were jealous. And they were quiet until they finally threw me into a pit with scorpions and snakes. Then they sold me as a slave, and I was lost. No one cared for me. Until finally my master's wife, Potiphar's wife, she loved me, and she threw me into the pit. She caused me to be in a state of incarcerated. And then I stayed a long time incarcerated, where all the other Egyptians were incarcerated, and after all that I've gone through, I have to tell you, I don't want anyone's love. All I want is that the one who created mankind, the one who created the mountains, may he love me. Everyone else, I'm not interested in your love. So he was telling him, you don't love me. You don't know how to love me. And Tosfos brings the following story. There was a woman whose husband passed away, and she would go to his grave and she'd wail and cry day after day over his grave. And there was a man who was hung by the king's order, and the king had ordered that there should be a guard to ensure that that body remain hung, that the relatives won't come and steal the body and bury it. And the woman is standing right next to this man and she's crying over her husband's grave. I miss you. She's crying. How could she really cares for her husband? And then this man, this guard, comes over to the woman and seduces her. And they go together, and after they've done what they've done, they come back and the body's missing. So the guard says, oh, if the king finds out, I'm a dead man. That was the body I was responsible for. So the woman says, don't worry. Take my husband's body out of the grave. Hang him. Who's going to know the difference? So much time has passed. One body, another body, who knows? And they took her body out, she and the guard took the body out of the grave, and they hung it. And Tosis is bringing the story to illustrate that the whole time that she was crying over the grave, she wasn't crying over her husband. She was crying over herself. And really, she wasn't connected to her husband at all. At a few minutes after she's crying over her husband's grave, she could go and sin with someone else. And right thereafter, she could do such cruelty to her husband to take his body out of the grave and hang it. And this was minutes after she was lying over the grave crying. So we see the difference between loving someone else and loving ourselves, and crying over someone else and crying over ourselves. And this also we discussed last week on Thursday night when someone asked about how does sorrow go together with feeling happy. And we said that all too often our sorrow is really for ourselves. We express it as though it's over someone else, but really it's over ourselves. The Gemara brings that there was an Amora whose son lost a son. He lost a grandson. And he wanted to join his son in mourning. And another Amora met him and said, what you doing? You want people to come and comfort you? You want to eat the meal that they always give to the mourners? You're hungry? So he said, what do you mean? Halachically, don't I have to mourn? So he said, no, it's your grandson, you don't have to mourn. So Rav Avram Shapiro, may ever Fushlema, may he be well, he said that from this Gemara we learn that he was telling him, even a great person like you, you better stop before you start mourning and ask yourself, why are you mourning? Can't it be that maybe you just want people to come and commiserate with you? Maybe you want people to come and bring you the good food they always bring the mourners? Think about it. So even a Namora got this words of rebuke. Hey, before you mourn, check what your inner... What's really driving you from inside? Rav Shimshon Fal Hirsch writes the same thought about when Hagar takes Yishmael as he's dying and places him under a bush. He says, if Hagar loved Yishmael, then she'd be with him the last minute. What Hagar did when she put him under the bush, Hagar was saying, I want to protect myself. It's painful for me to see this. I want to ease the pain on myself. And so she let Yishmael lie there in the moments that would be his dying moments, separate from his mother, just to ease the pain on herself. And we also we always have to be careful, and that's the inner moral of the story of Shlomo HaMelech and the two women, as we'll learn later this year. So we have to be careful, even in the times that we think we love, we have to test ourselves, and certainly in the times that we're sad, we have to test ourselves. The Gemara says that Amnon hated Tamar so much because she castrated him. And what?
I said, I would hate her too.
Here there are different understandings as to the Gemara in Sanhedrin Chafal Famadal. And the Gemara seems to have had a tradition that way. The Gemara begins by saying maybe he got caught in a hair and that caused him to be a krut shafchat, a person who has a slice that causes him to dribble when he goes. That's called krut shafchat. And what's it her fault, the Gemara says? The Gemara says, no, didn't get caught. She did it. She got her hairs together in a way that she could, that she castrated him. So here again, there are deeper understandings as to what's going on here. And some want to say that again, naturally the Chida says you can't do this with a hair. You can't castrate a person with a hair. That's not it's not natural. But God wanted this to happen, that he should get this punishment, that he should hate her, and that he won't want to marry her, and that ultimately Avshalom will kill him for the shame that he did to his sister, and David will get the punishment that he was supposed to get, that it was all paid back through Amnon and Tamar and Avshalom. There are different understandings as to what happened over here. Tom?
Isn't the option of marriage pretty much eliminated if that's the situation of the man?
So, two things. A, the Chida is explaining that that's why Hashem did it, to eliminate the option of marriage. And the Aruch Laner writes that she wanted him to be a krut shavcha, because a krut shavcha, the Torah says, is not allowed to marry within the Jewish people. But he is allowed to marry a ger. And she, by doing this, was trying to ensure that he would marry her ultimately. He couldn't, after she did this, he couldn't marry into the Jewish people, but he could marry her. Yeah?
Two things. As far as I know, if you're physically brother and sister, even if you're from the Torah, brother and sister, there is a problem.
That's Midrabanan, yeah.
The other thing is what happened afterwards. Why Avram killed him? I mean, nobody put him to court or something. Like
oh,
that?
So we didn't yet discuss what Avshalom did. That Emil Shem we're going to pick up with next week. What's the halachic basis for what Avshalom did, if there is one? That Bezalat Shem next week. We're going to start with Avshalom and David's reaction. That's where we go.
What my first thing?
What?
What I said.
What was the first thing?
It's not really possible.
So that's Midrabanan. I don't know if in those times it was forbidden.
Yeah.